Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Next week will mark the 50th anniversary of the first issue of Rolling Stone magazine with John Lennon on the cover. The occasion is going to be marked with a 4-hour documentary by Alex Gibney airing on HBO November 6th and 7th, as well as the publication of Joe Hagen's biography of Rolling Stone editor and publisher Jan Wenner. It's called Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine. And Joe Hagen joins me now. Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me here.
It's my pleasure. Before we get into the early days of Rolling Stone and its influence and all that sort of stuff, I'm always interested in process here, and I know that Jan Wenner had tried this with at least 2 other writers before you over the years, and that he always yanked his approval. And now you've got the book out, and after its publication, he has disavowed the book, calling it deeply flawed and tawdry and all that sort of stuff, which makes me wonder, why'd you get yourself into this in the first place?
Well, and it has been a very kind of, volatile, really, from the get-go, because just of the nature of the man himself, you know, he's a powerful man with a long history, and like a lot of people like him, likes to have control. But the truth is, he asked me to write it. That was how this whole thing started. And, of course, I looked at those 2 previous attempts that didn't work out, and was pretty nervous about that. But I also saw the incredible opportunity of this story. I mean, 5 decades of American popular culture, one man who was like really at the center of a lot of it from so much of that time, you know, captured so many of the kind of changes in the culture since coming out of the 60s, reinvented youth culture. Anyway, the story was so rich, I knew that it could be great, but it had to be done independently. That was the key. And after a lot of negotiation, I convinced them to let me do it that way. And I, you know, from the start, just by virtue of telling them it had to be independent, I knew it could be tricky. And it did turn out to be pretty tricky.
Yeah. But at the beginning, you got all the access you wanted to not only his life, but also his files and his documents. Is it true that Jan Wenner held on to every letter and everything he ever wrote because he just knew someday he'd be famous and somebody would want to see it?
Well, absolutely. In fact, it was really just jaw-dropping when I first encountered his archive. I mean, there were like 500 boxes. It was cataloged. It was searchable. It had files and files of correspondence with Mick Jagger, John Lennon, Yoko Ono. I mean, you name it, right? And these were like, in many cases, very personal letters that took you into a time and a place, like, you know, the late 60s or the early 70s, and all the real nature of all of their relationships and how things worked and how did so-and-so get on the cover in 1971 and why did it happen and all these kinds of things. And I saw just all this incredible storylines that were coming out of, you know, a single file of letters.
So let's go to the covers since you mentioned it. How did he get John Lennon? This is 1967, the height of the Beatles' fame. How did he get him to be the cover guy?
Well, initially, he had never met any of the Beatles. He's just a 21-year-old kid who's out of the blue as the chutzpah to make this, you know, rock and roll newspaper, which he kind of, you know, puts together from things he begs, borrows, and steals. And, you know, he's like any entrepreneur, you know, a startup, really. And the first Rolling Stone cover with John Lennon was a film still of John Lennon in a movie called How I Won the War, which is sort of a comedy. And so he hadn't met John Lennon yet, but flash forward a year, he figures out there's a John Lennon has an album that's been banned because of its cover. It was John and Yoko naked in a studio portrait, and Jan publishes it on the cover of Rolling Stone, and it's such a huge splash, and it creates so much controversy that John Lennon and Yoko begin to see Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone as kind of a vehicle for them, that they can, you know, make some noise with Jan's partnership, and they use Rolling Stone to create a different narrative from the Beatles, right? This is when John and Yoko are sort of going solo, as it were, away from the Beatles. And Jan Wenner becomes a part of it. And eventually he meets them, befriends them, and gets one of the greatest interviews of the 20th century, an interview with John Lennon after the Beatles have just broken up. And he tells them the full story, raw, unvarnished story of his life in the Beatles.
What's fascinating to me is that Jan Wenner used the first picture of John Lennon without asking permission. He used the cover photo from Two Virgins without asking permission. And then later on, published a book of his conversation with John Lennon without John Lennon's permission, and that ruined their relationship, right?
Well, what happened was that after the big interview of December 1970, it was published in early 1971, two issues, just really long interview, very rich, deep interview, which John Lennon was happy with the portraits, by the way, by Annie Leibovitz. Jan decided that this interview was so fantastic and so powerful that he had to publish it as a book or a record, was another idea he had. And John Lennon felt like he had kind of done enough damage with that interview, because in the interview he maligned Paul McCartney and he was attacking people. It was, you know, pretty unbelievable stuff. Well, Jan decides, even though John Lennon doesn't want to do it, Jan Wenner publishes the book anyway against his will. It was a book called Lennon Remembers. And thereafter, John Lennon called it Lennon Regrets, because he was so upset and he never saw Jan Wenner again.
Mm. Speaking of classic rock stars and their relationship with him, how did Mick Jagger and Keith Richards feel about the name of their band becoming the name of a rock and roll magazine?
Well, that was kind of a real surprising revelation for me. You know, it's kind of obvious on its face, but as soon as Rolling Stone was published, first issue, a lawyer representing the Rolling Stones sent a cease and desist letter, said, stop publication, you're, you know, exploiting our commercial trademark, the Rolling Stone name. And, you know, it basically, what was it, Keith Richards is quoted in my interview, said, what a thief, we thought, you know. That was the first reaction when they saw the name of the magazine. And eventually this becomes kind of a subtext of Jan Wenner's relationship with Mick Jagger over the years. And at first it was something of a joke, but then sometimes it wasn't a joke, and, you know, their relationship was up and down, as so many of these rock and roll relationships were. But the whole, you know, genesis of it was the name Rolling Stone.
When he started the magazine, was it hard for Wenner and his associates to convince advertisers to buy space in a rock magazine? Because I think there was only Crawdaddy doing the same thing maybe a year before them. Do I have the timeline right?
Yeah, that's right. And, well, listen, this was a very small newspaper at first. I think it had a circulation of 40,000, and that was probably more than they actually had. But, you know, a lot of advertisements that were just from head shops in Haight-Ashbury back in 1967, or like the local radio station, right, the Freeform radio station in San Francisco, or the Fillmore, which is the famous Fillmore, you know, music venue. Bill Graham ran it. He bought some ads. So it was all very local and kind of a couple of record label ads, and that's how it started. But as it got bigger and more powerful, you know, all the record labels came in to buy ad pages, and it really grew into kind of had to have a symbiotic relationship with the record business.
Now, speaking of that, there are several detractors in your book who essentially say that Jan Wenner sold out to the record companies and that he let artists control what was written about them in Rolling Stone. How true do you think that is?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I mean, on the one hand, he did give favor to certain artists who he really liked personally and wanted to be friends with. You know, from John Lennon to Mick Jagger to Dylan, those are the big three for him. They always were. And other friends that he had, like Art Garfunkel was a friend of his, and, you know, who would get a cover against some people's better judgment. But, you know, then on the other hand, you know, while he was, you know, maybe seeming to be currying favor with some of the rock stars, he could be hard-hitting as well and send reporters to do tough pieces on artists and infuriate them, right, and infuriate record labels. I mean, there are points in my book where the head of Columbia Records or the head of, you know, David Geffen, the head of Asylum back in the 70s, they'd pull all their ads. They'd get so infuriated with Jan. So he wasn't afraid to bite the hand that fed him. And over the years, he gained a reputation as being mercurial, they would call him. You know, you didn't renew where you were going to end up in the wash with Jan, and I guess that's what made it interesting.
Did he and Rolling Stone have the ability to make or break bands?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there are certain new artists who, if suddenly they're on the cover of Rolling Stone, look, they're in this kind of continuum with the Beatles and Dylan and all these other great artists. That's going to make their profile really high and can really add to critical favor and sales, and sure, and that was definitely happened in a lot of cases. And, you know, for Bruce Springsteen to get on that cover, that was really meaningful to him, he said, because he was one of the first generation of rock stars that grew up with Rolling Stone, and they learned, you know, what rock and roll meant and how to be a rock star, from reading Rolling Stone. And so when he was on the cover, that was big for him, and he obviously did pretty well for himself.
One of the stories that I love is that not only was Rolling Stone capable of selling records for up-and-coming acts or even established acts, he could sell records for dead acts. Like when he put Jim Morrison on the cover and said, he's hot, he's sexy, he's dead, the Doors catalog ran out the door at record stores, didn't it?
That's right. And, well, that became more and more of a trend, especially after 1980. And, you know, when John Lennon died, this was sort of an end of an era. And, you know, Jan's sort of attention began over time to turn to, you know, turning the older acts, the most famous acts, into institutions of, you know, in themselves and businesses in themselves. I mean, after that, you'll always be able to sell, he would always be able to sell lots of copies with the Rolling Stones on the cover. You know, for 30 or 40 years, this was true.
Yep.
And Jan recognized that early on, that, you know, burnishing the legacies of the big acts was a, you know, worked.
But for the first decade, they were all white acts, weren't they?
Well, that is definitely true. It was always a white rock and roll magazine. I mean, it wasn't explicitly, though, that way. There were black artists on the cover occasionally, but they didn't, you know, Jan didn't find that they sold to his audience, which was largely, like, you know, white men. And so he didn't put a lot of them on there, and there was, you know, not as much attention to black artists, and that became a real criticism over time. And he, you know, didn't work out for him, I wouldn't say, critically or financially, when hip hop came along, which the magazine completely ignored.
Mm-hmm. In addition to the music writing, Jan Wenner, as an editor, also saw the value in non-music writers like yourself and Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson and Matt Taibbi. But I'm curious whether he started relying on that sort of stuff more because other people were jumping into the music criticism print business, and he wanted to differentiate Rolling Stone yet again.
Well, yeah, listen, he was always interested in journalism, but the degree to which journalism, especially kind of like the real ambitious journalism of a guy like Hunter Thompson, the degree to which that became central really ramped up in the early 70s with Hunter Thompson, who became kind of something of a muse for Jan, and a sort of, I guess you'd call he set the bar for what you could do. You could break new ground as a journalist. And in the early 70s, journalism itself became something like its own version of rock and roll. Everybody wanted to be really ambitious around journalism, and Tom Wolfe was writing all kinds of amazing stuff. He publishes what became The Right Stuff in 1973 in Rolling Stone magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jan, it's not so much that he is cued into whether it's rock and roll or journalism. Wherever the ambition is, that's where Jan went. Jan was attracted to ambition and power, and, you know, at one point it's going to be rock, the next journalism, and later it was politics. He moved his whole magazine to focus on politics in 1972 and later on when Carter ran. And he wanted to be a part of that. And he actually said, politics is the rock and roll of the 70s, he was quoted as saying. So he had a real gut for the zeitgeist, and he just followed it.
But we can't talk about the journalism in Rolling Stone without talking about the article from 2014 called A Rape on Campus, which
yes,
created a huge amount of controversy. And did he ever publicly apologize?
Well, he did apologize in a fashion to the woman who ended up suing the magazine, Nicole Aramo, who was former associate dean there, who was more or less sort of implicated in the article, which turned out to have some fake parts of it, as, you know, being negligent towards rape victims at the University of Virginia. And he sort of apologized to her, although in the same breath he said, I've suffered as much as you have, he said under testimony.
Oh.
And that didn't help his case. You know, listen, he didn't want to cede any ground. You know, he was it's not uncommon for reporters and publishers to do everything they can not to admit defeat, but and he did resist and for some time in that way, but eventually they gave up the ghost and, you know, recanted the entire thing. And as and by then, though, there was, the damage had been done really, yeah. to Rolling Stone. And I think it did seriously damage their reputation. And at a time when they were having financial troubles as well, and a lot of advertisers pulled their money from the magazine as a result of that story.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the financial nature of this, because Winter has already sold other publications he owned, called Us Weekly and Men's Journal, to AMI, a group that is it has ties to Donald Trump. But he recently put Rolling Stone up for sale. Is that because of this financial trouble that was brought on by that, or is it just the digital era is catching up with a print magazine?
It's the digital era is caught up. He made some financial bad decisions, over a decade ago, and he had a big loan outstanding that caused a lot of trouble for him. And eventually, as the revenue was declining with the magazine business, he wasn't able to kind of keep up. And he was very late to kind of commit resources to the internet, and that did finally catch up. And then the UVA thing was probably a tipping point. I mean, reported a couple of weeks ago that the magazine's revenue is only $10 million, which is, much less than you need to run a magazine. Clearly, they're underwater. And if you think about the UVA lawsuits, he's already shelled out several million just in lost court cases. So he's definitely hit a point where he had to sell.
And I mentioned Donald Trump, so I've got to ask you about a line you have in the book where you kind of imply that Jan Winter's work has led us to where we are now. You say, quote, "The solar eclipse of Donald Trump signaled the complete triumph of celebrity culture over every aspect of American life." Does Winter get credit for that, or blame, I guess?
Well, I wouldn't credit or blame him directly. What I would say is that the two biggest magazines, the two most successful magazines of the 1970s, were People Magazine and Rolling Stone.
Mm.
And they both did something similar. It was, they used to call that the Me Decade. Tom Wolfe coined it that. And it was there was a period in which celebrity was being reinvented for the new generation. And it was about confession. It was about showing more skin. It was about a new way of preening for cameras. And a lot of the culture we see today kind of grew out of that. And Jan Winter and Rolling Stone, in addition to all the great journalism they did and iconic magazine covers and all the music they celebrated that everybody loves, okay, they also, helped pioneer some of the aspects of celebrity that took over the culture, mm-hmm. especially when the internet came along and kind of catalyzed it all. And it all became about, as I say in the book, the Me Decade became Me Decades. And now, I would argue, we've come to a point where we have a president who's come out of this celebrity culture, and he's the Me President.
Yep.
I mean, everybody can see that is true. And I sort of draw a line back to the Me Decade.
I've got to ask you about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which Jan Winter was instrumental in co-founding. It's in Cleveland, Ohio. I visited it twice. It's really a lot of fun. But there's controversy about the acts that are included, the acts that are excluded from it, and also about the process of who gets to go and how they have to pay for their own tables. I talked to Graham Nash about this years ago, and he said, "Please stop inducting me. I can't afford it."
Yes. Steve Miller said something similar to me when I interviewed him for this book. He expressed his dissatisfaction during his own induction.
Yep.
Controversy has always surrounded the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because it, like the cover of the Rolling Stone, everybody wants in, but there's only, one is a bottleneck, which one must pass, and a gatekeeper. And many people have come to believe that Jan Winter is the main gatekeeper and that his tastes have arbitrated who got in and who didn't. Now, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has always argued that this is true, that they have committees and advisory boards, and it's all by a vote and so forth, but one thing you can point to is that a lot of rock stars who want to get in have always campaigned directly to Jan Winter,
mm-hmm.
including John Bon Jovi, by the way, who Jan dislikes personally.
Oh.
He has been nominated this year, which may give a lie to that idea that Jan has total power, but he was always seen as the guy. who was arbitrating that, and it kind of became his reputation, frankly. Yeah. And it wasn't one he necessarily tried to dispel, if you know what I mean.
He liked being a guy with his thumb on the scale.
Absolutely. He always was, you know, so it was natural to him.
The book is called Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone. Jan Wenner has said, nope, I don't like the book, but a lot of other people do. And Joe, I got to tell you, having him come out and say that, creating a little controversy for you, has probably helped you sell a few extra copies.
Well, you know, I think that's probably true. And in a funny way, it's in the spirit of Jan Wenner, who has always loved controversy and always, you know, been very eager to create controversy, usually for his magazine, you know. In this case, I take his dissatisfaction at face value, but I do appreciate that, you know, he's kind of inadvertently given a lot of energy to my book. But let me also say that, you know, I like Jan. He's a charming guy. I understand him. And my commitment and devotion to him was this book. And he may not see it now, but I believe this book is a great legacy for him. And the reason is it's because it's a true story. And true stories aren't always good stories for people. I mean, they're fun for everybody else to read, but they, you know, it's a warts and all biography. And maybe over time he'll come to see that that was the best way.
Well, congratulations on it, and thank you so much for your time today.
Paul, I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Joe Hagan, the book is Sticky Fingers. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.